This is our third session talking about the issue of music and worship, developing discernment in this very important area of our lives personally, but more specifically in terms of our corporate worship together. And we're going to be moving forward, but based upon some very important foundations that we have laid the last couple of weeks. And let me say that this is a third session, and if you have not been here for the first two, at some point you would want to go back and listen to that to get a perspective of the issue and how we are approaching it and some of the things that I'm kind of taking for granted as we get into some more specific topics. At this point, we're not yet dealing with worship music specifically. We're looking at broader things regarding the topic of music and really trying to appreciate the principles of Scripture that would apply to any kind of music, and then on the basis of that, begin to look at the area of worship specifically. That is still ahead, worship is, because we are just about halfway through the material that has to do with music as a whole in Scripture. And if you remember back to last time, we identified three main categories that we want to be looking at when we strive to evaluate biblically whatever kind of music. The first of those is fairly objective. It's fairly straightforward because in that case, there are words to look at. And I'm talking about the lyrics of whatever song that we are considering and analyzing those things according to biblical principles of communication. There is a second element to music that we evaluate as well, and that is moving from the words that may be connected with a song to the actual sound of the music itself, the musical sound. And last time we emphasized that part as well and talked about the inherent effect that musical sound can have upon us and gave some illustrations of how that works in some cases and talked about how because of the influence that music has upon our emotions, our attitudes, our responses, our actions, it comes to have a moral significance because it can affect what we're thinking, what we're feeling, what we're doing, how we are responding. And that leads us to what we're going to talk about this afternoon. We're still talking here about the musical sound. And so this first slide just says follow-up thoughts regarding musical sound, because we're kind of bridging from this to the third category. You remember it was number one, lyrics, number two, sound, and number three, associations. And really, it's hard to separate the sound from the association idea. In fact, if we wanted to probe the sound part a little bit more and ask, why is it that this or that piece of music has a certain influence on us, it is something produced basically by some kind of association that is created between the musical sound and our emotions and thoughts and so forth. So we're trying to put all this together and moving in the direction of the third point regarding associations. As I do this, we're also trying to elaborate a little bit on the whole question of the moral significance of music. And these two things are tied together, and we want to make the connections here. So, first of all, as we kind of review and move forward, I want to make this point. I alluded to this last time, that in a broad sense, every created thing, even inanimate objects, can be said to have a sort of moral significance. Because if God created them, they are reflections of the character of God. And furthermore, because the whole world has been touched by the curse, we can expect that there are factors, even in the inanimate creation, that are suffering under conditions that are not as God designed them to be originally. Okay? In other words, sin has touched everything and has damaged everything to some extent. And on this basic level, even the sort of natural realm, the created world that we would not identify as human, has some kind of moral significance, first of all, because it reflects God's character and because it has been affected by the curse. The second point I would make about this issue of the morality is that things take on further moral significance. In addition to that basic idea that I just mentioned, they take on further moral significance when they are used by human beings, moral beings, beings that have the capacity to actually make choices that could be described as right or wrong, ethical choices. Things take on further moral significance when they are used by human beings to accomplish good or bad purposes. In other words, we may like to look at things in a kind of abstract way and say, this is just a sound. How can we identify that as good or bad? The reality is that that sound was produced by human beings. And that sound is being used to accomplish a particular purpose. And even though in a sense, in and of itself, it might be hard to identify something like music as good or bad, it doesn't exist in a vacuum that way. It is a tool that is used by human beings to accomplish particular purposes. And so you have to ask the question, what is the music being used to do? It's just like something along the lines of a weapon. Okay, let's suppose I had a gun here. That's just a thing. I would be comfortable, in a sense, saying that it's morally neutral. But as soon as somebody picks it up and does something with it, it takes on a moral significance. It can be used for good things. You can go out and hunt a deer and then feed the church some Sunday, right? That's acceptable. We have scripture that backs that up as something that God would allow us to do and that He blesses. But the same weapon can be used to accomplish something wrong, and it can be used to commit murder or whatever. We recognize that it's just a thing, but it is a thing used by sinful human beings to accomplish certain purposes, and those purposes, those uses, become good or bad because there are people connected with it. Now, we can say that about a lot of things. We can say that about music, but music actually has a whole other layer of moral significance to it, which is my third consideration here. Music has an additional level of moral significance. Why? Because it is a medium of communication. It is a way of sending messages, of imparting ideas. And those messages that are being communicated may be good messages or bad messages. And this is probably the most to-the-point concept as we consider the question of the morality of music. Music is a kind of language. And if there are good words and bad words that we can speak because of what is being communicated by them, then in this area of communication, this kind of communication, we would have to say the same thing. Let me share with you a, I think, fairly well-known statement by the longtime conductor of the New York Philharmonic, Leonard Bernstein. And he said this about music. Music is heightened speech. After all, what causes such a heightening? Intensified emotion. Things like hunger, impatience, and so forth. Certainly, the deepest universals that we all share are emotions or affects. We all have the same capacity for passion, fear, anticipation, and aggression. We all display the same physiological manifestations of affect. Our eyebrows go up with anticipation. Our hearts pound with passion. And fear affects us universally with goose flesh. And in the sense that music may express those affective goings on, then it must indeed be a universal language. So I'm not quoting this to recommend this particular author in general or to commend you whatever his theology or lack thereof was, but he was an expert in the area of music, and his simple point is that because music has the ability to touch us deeply in areas that we all share as human beings, there is an important sense in which music is a language. It sends messages, it communicates, and therefore we analyze it according to biblical principles of communication. Now, if we have a question, well, it is still a non-verbal form of communication, right? where it's talking words that we all understand that are fairly black and white, we can analyze that pretty simply by just looking at the dictionary and by looking at the concepts shared in words and comparing those to Scripture. How would you go about dealing with a non-verbal form of communication? How would you analyze that scripturally? And this brings me to the main idea that we want to develop here today, and that is this, that non-verbal forms of communication function through what we call symbolic association. Certain things represent other things. And specifically, as far as music is concerned, certain sounds represent certain ideas, feelings, etc. This is how non-verbal forms of communication work. Music is not the only non-verbal form of communication, and we'll talk about some other examples. The way they function is through symbolic or representative associations. Now, that might seem a little bit vague. What am I actually getting on? I want to introduce here two categories that will help us get a handle on this. The first category of association is really kind of following up on last week. And I think it speaks to the issue of how music can have a sort of intrinsic influence or effect upon us. And that is what we would call associations that are intrinsic or natural, which is different from another kind of association we'll talk about a little bit later. And I appreciate the way that this is developed in some books that have been very helpful to me in this area, written by a fellow by the name of Scott Annual, who really does a good job to analyze this. I don't know that these categories are original with him, but certainly a helpful way to lay them out. Some of these associations, where non-verbally one thing represents another, some of these associations are intrinsic or natural. In other words, no matter what part of the world you're from, no matter what your background is, no matter what your life experiences are, there are certain things that are universal and that are represented in a symbolic way through music. Now, before we talk about music, let's consider some other forms of non-verbal communication that actually work the same way. And I got a picture here of a young lady playing the flute, and there's a smile on her face. You don't know a thing about her. It's just a picture, so you can't hear a word she's saying. You don't know the context or exactly what's going on. But non-verbally, because of the particular look on her face, there is something about a smile that naturally communicates happiness. She's enjoying herself. She thinks something is funny, whatever the motive may be. But she is happy, and you know that just by looking at her face. In other words, facial expressions non-verbally communicate because naturally they are associated with certain feelings. Okay? Now, a smile is one thing. Here's another picture. What if I got up this morning to preach and I was trying to make the kind of points I was out of 1 Peter chapter 5 and talking about how the Lord is assuring us and comforting us by His grace that He's going to preserve us and protect us and see us through to the end, and we need to trust in Him and so forth. And all the time that I'm saying those very positive things, that's what my face looks like. Would you say I'm sending mixed messages, particularly if my voice also sounds like what the face looks like? Okay? This is an angry face. Or something. Okay. There's a rage, there's an intensity there that just by looking at it, because that's what people naturally tend to look like when they're in a certain state of mind and emotion, it just communicates it. You don't have to say anything. So that even if you're saying something good, but there's something else nonverbal going on in another direction, it could, in effect, undermine your whole point you're trying to get across. The look speaks, even though there are no words. And I could give you plenty of other examples. What does this young lady look like is going on. She's worried about it. So she's troubled. She's trying to figure out what's going on, what to do, anxiety, whatever you'd call it. But there again, without saying anything, there's something non-verbally being communicated by her facial expression that says something. And, of course, couldn't leave out a crying baby, right? That kind of look, accompanied by tears, naturally communicates. A picture like this communicates even though we're not hearing any words to it. So, there are some cases where there is a very natural or intrinsic connection between the nonverbal and what is actually being said. And when things are at that level, it's relatively easy to figure out what the message is and then to go on to ask, is this an appropriate or an inappropriate message? But it's not always that easy. And I recognize that most of the examples I gave you last time were on the level of a natural or intrinsic association, because somehow the sound sort of mimics the feelings, and there was some intrinsic association that is generally shared by all cultures between those kinds of sounds and the emotions of happiness or sadness or excitement or whatever it was. You say, not all music is that easy to analyze. You know, this is making me want to feel a certain way, or this is creating in me a wrong feeling or a wrong desire or promoting the wrong thing inside me. Okay. Is there any other way beyond intrinsic association that we can analyze the meaning of music or what music is communicating nonverbally? And I believe there is, and that's the second category here. When you're dealing especially with music that you just maybe enjoy, you think it's delightful, it just generally is a positive experience, but you would be hard-pressed to analyze very much specific attitudes that are being created in you through this, you do have this other category of association to consider, and what is called conventional or cultural association. Now, the reality is that even verbal communication, for the most part, works because of this. And I was just talking about this in one of my classes this week. Do you realize there is no intrinsic connection between the word, for example, pulpit? I mean, what is there about those letters combined together, P-U-L-P-I-T, pulpit, that intrinsically means this thing that I'm standing behind? There is no natural connection between the words that we use and the ideas or realities that they represent. Now, you have exceptions. There's something called onomatopoeia, right? Where something sounds like what it actually is. And so when I say buzz, that word inherently has an inherent association with that bzz sound. But we have a category called onomatopoeia because most of our words don't work that way. That is an exception. And word meanings are established by associations within a particular culture, that by our practices, our convention, certain words take on meaning according to usage. And at some point, somebody, for whatever reason, started to use the word P-U-L-P-I-T for this thing. And because so many people started to use it, that's what it now says it means in the dictionary. There is no necessary connection between the word pulpit and this thing. Most of our language is conventional that way. And you can also think of this in terms of words that we would call bad words or swear words, okay? To spell out certain words that are inappropriate, okay? And I'm not going to give the examples. But there is no inherent connection between those combinations of letters in a word and some bad thing, okay? Those are just letters put together in a certain sequence. It is by convention that those things take on a certain meaning and end up being considered appropriate or inappropriate. Now, what works with verbal communication also works with nonverbal communication. And so there would be things that are speaking without words that are sending a certain message because of an association that they have within a particular setting, particular culture, people group, or whatever. And again, let me give you some examples that don't relate to music. Take a look at this. And I don't want to just be hyper-analyzing everything, but there's a sense in which everything is sending you a nonverbal message. Okay? When you go into a restaurant and your dinner is served on a paper plate, especially if it's a hot dog, okay, that is communicating something. That's communicating this is an informal setting, relaxed atmosphere, don't expect anything too expensive or fancy. This is very plain, and we are cheapskates. If, on the other hand, you go somewhere else and it's all this fine china and silverware and these fancy goblets and so forth, okay, they don't tend to use, you know, paper plates at the $50 a plate steakhouses, okay? There's something that's being communicated nonverbally, even by the things that they serve the food on. Now, most of the time, we're not really thinking about this and don't really matter that much, and this isn't a right or wrong thing, but my point is that by convention and practice and culture, just about everything is sending some kind of message nonverbally. And let me give you some other examples here. This is an American flag, as you can see. And it's formed up of red and white lines, stripes, and then a field of 50 stars. And we recognize, okay, 50 stars correspond to 50 states. That would be kind of a natural association. But why a star? Okay. Well, it communicates dignity or importance or specialness, and so we're going to call ourselves by stars, okay? Maybe. Okay, why the colors red, white, and blue? We have, in our culture, not even to show a flag, but to say red, white, and blue, that communicates patriotism, I don't know, the War of Independence, 50 states together, and we trust in God and all this kind of thing. Specific things maybe from our background, our history, that go into our culture. And so when we say red, white, and blue, that communicates American patriotism. Right? But what is there inherently about red, white, and blue that means American patriotism? Let me say, well, red is the blood that the soldiers spilt, and it speaks of courage, and white is purity, and blue is dignity. Okay. The reality is that all kinds of people use red, white, and blue. And it may or may not mean those things to them. And it may not represent American patriotism at all. As a matter of fact, I have a list of about 30 countries whose flags are formed by red, white, and blue. And it runs a span. I mean, there's Asia, Cambodia. There's Latin America, Chile, Cuba, Puerto Rico, red, white, and blue. Europe, France, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, Russia. Their flag is red, white, and blue now. And it goes on and on. So there's nothing inherent about red, white, and blue that communicates United States of America. And in fact, some of these flags have stripes kind of like ours, and some of them even use stars. So there. The reason that we associate that with the United States of America is because that's the meaning it has come to communicate in our culture. That's an example of what I call a conventional or cultural sort of association. It nonverbally means something to people from that particular group. Now, I'm going to put another example up here, and I feel bad even putting this up in a church. But even my feeling bad is an example of what I'm getting at, that images can communicate powerful things nonverbally. This is a swastika. There is nothing inherently wrong about combining two black lines in that particular combination and structure. It's just lines. And as a matter of fact, if you look into the background of this swastika symbol, it has been around for centuries and actually was a symbol that is used in certain Eastern religions to communicate what to them are very positive things about peace and so forth. But I doubt that there's a place in the world today that when you pull up a swastika, that's what comes to your mind. Because this was taken up by Hitler to represent his ideology and the whole effort of the Nazis and what they stood for and the extermination of the Jews and everything that comes to your mind with World War II. To where, at this point in history, that is an offensive symbol that you're really not supposed to be displaying in public. Okay? I mean, it's just lines. What's the big deal? It's just lines. It's not saying anything verbally. But because of a cultural association, because of what it represented at a certain time, in a certain place, and came to have that meaning all over the world, we would say, I don't really want to be running this off on a church flyer that's promoting some outreach activity, because it might give people the wrong message. Okay. Nonverbal associations can be very powerful. Now, the question is, do the same kinds of things apply reference to music? That the musical sound itself, in addition to whatever its intrinsic association is, could have another level of meaning in a particular culture that would make it problematic for us. And specifically, in terms of what the New Testament constantly warns us about regarding the cosmos, what's called the world, the present evil age, and some of the key passages that you see there. Well, that is what I want us to consider, that in analyzing these, especially the conventional associations of music, we ought to be identifying and avoiding those elements of our culture, including those elements in music that have a strong association with that which is ungodly and that represents worldly things. So let me have you go to some of these passages. Of course, some of these you would be able to quote. In Romans chapter 12, tells us not to be conformed to the world, that there is this system or force out there that is dead set under the reign of Satan, dead set in opposition to God and communicating all kinds of things that it's trying to use to influence us away from God. And Paul tells us, in response to the gospel, by the mercies of God, don't be conformed to that world, but to be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5. We read a verse from here the first time, that has to do with discernment, but that came up in a broader context of walking as children of light in the midst of a very dark world. And it says in Ephesians 5:11, take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. For it is shameful even to speak of the things that they do in secret. But when anything is exposed by the light, it becomes visible. And we're challenged in verse 15 to walk not as unwise, but as wise, and to live circumspect lives. Part of that is avoiding the darkness, the moral darkness that characterizes the unregenerate world. The question is, could the music be symbolically connected with that darkness and be non-verbally expressing that darkness? That's what we're considering. Titus chapter 2, another important passage that once again ties together the gospel with the changed and separated life of the believer. In fact, it states it as a purpose for which God's grace has appeared in our lives. Titus chapter 2 and verse 11, the grace of God, verse 12, trains us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions, to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in this present age. And of course, 1 John 2, verses 15 to 17, we talked about last time. We're not to love the world, and that there are these sinful passions that the world is dead set on promoting in us. And the question is, could music be one of the vehicles that they use to non-verbally influence us and get those messages across? Well, I think the answer is yes. I think you get a hint of that the very first time that music is even mentioned in the Bible. Last week, we talked about how music is a reflection of the image of God, and in principle, it goes back to Genesis chapter 1, but actually, the first reference to music specifically is in Genesis chapter 4. It doesn't say a great deal about it, but we made this point back when we were doing our study in Genesis, that at this point in the book, there's a big distinction between the descendants of Cain, who represent the seed of the serpent, and on the other hand, the descendants of Seth, son of Adam, who represents the people of God. And there are different things that each one is connected with, associated with. There are different values that each one is promoting. And all the way through Genesis, you ought to always be asking the question, does this person, does this family, does this movement represent the seed of the serpent, or does it represent the seed of the woman? Specifically, at this point, is it the seed of Cain or the seed of Seth? Now, here's the interesting thing about Cain. If you look at Genesis chapter 4, it says this, starting at verse 20. Here are some of the descendants of Cain. Adah bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the lyre and pipe. First specific reference to music in the Bible. Zillah also bore Tubal-Cain. He was the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. And in contrast to all of that, of course, we have the story there about Lamech. Things get worse and worse. In contrast to all of that, verse 25, Adam knew his wife and was born Seth, because God has appointed for me another offspring instead of Abel. Cain was disqualified. He represents a whole other line. So we start over with Seth. To Seth also was a son born, called his name Enosh. At that time, people, specifically the Sethites, began to call upon the name of Yahweh. What do you see would be a difference between these two lines? The people that we would call the builders of civilization in Genesis tend to be the seed of the serpent. It doesn't stop here. The whole concept of a city, of people getting together, tends to have bad associations in the book of Genesis. Nimrod, Tower of Babel, and so forth. The people of God, Seth, Abraham, and so forth, what stands out about them is their personal relationship with God, their faith, their worship, and so forth. The people that tend to be advancing culture tend to be the people of the world in New Testament terms. And specifically as identified here, those who dwell in tents and livestock, those who play music, and those who are forgers of instruments of bronze and iron. Those are different, all different kinds of what we would call technology that are used to advance civilization. Now, farming isn't wrong, music isn't wrong, tools aren't wrong, okay? In principle, these elements of technology are part of the dominion mandate, and there are people just doing what they naturally were created to do, and that is to be creative and to make the world a better place and so on and so forth. But it is not without significance that from the very beginning there is a strong connection between civilization and culture and the real movers and shakers in that realm and the line of Cain and the seed of the serpent. That is a consistent connection throughout the book, that the people of God tend to be kind of holding back from sort of the mainstream of human civilization. They don't fit very well because they have different values. And when they use these things, they're using them for different purposes and in different ways. And that sets the tone for the idea that, yes, music may be something that the world non-verbally uses to get across its messages, and therefore needs to be analyzed on a moral level. And if it is found out of keeping with the kinds of messages that honor the Lord, that it needs to be avoided, it needs to be rejected. Now, when I think about that principle, when I think about our culture, specifically recent American or more broadly Western culture, the main example that comes to my mind is the area of rock music. In terms of a form or a genre of music that from the beginning has been heavily associated with a godless agenda and has been a tool used by the world to get across its messages, not just verbally through the lyrics, but non-verbally through its intrinsic association. And even when we might have a hard time identifying that as far as a specific personal impact on us, through its conventional or cultural association with all that is the worst in the world. And I don't probably need to defend that notion, but I recognize that even that is a debated point. And so I think we would do well to consider it more closely. That rock music is a non-verbal means of expressing godless ideas, concepts, feelings, responses, lifestyles, and so forth. This is easy to establish, not even by looking at the Bible or reading Christian authors, but by just asking the people who were the creators and who are the promoters of that particular genre. And again, I want to be discreet here, but it helps us to listen to this from their own mouths. Here is one statement from John Oates of Hall & Oates, a rock band. "Rock and roll is 99% sex." This is another musician, Frank Zappa. "Rock music is sex. The big beat matches the body's rhythms." And I could reproduce for you quotation after quotation where the composers and the musicians themselves are saying that this music, whether in that intrinsic effect it has on you or the whole culture that it's promoting, this is the message that is being sent. Now, that was a long time ago. Those quotes are not particularly recent. Here is a more recent one. This is from an interview that Larry King did with Janet Jackson in March of 2008. And at this point in the interview, he's asking Janet Jackson what she thinks of British musician Amy Winehouse. He references the fact that she had a public substance abuse problem, and that people were raising questions about the fact that she earned 5 Grammys. And saying that the music industry was in effect rewarding her bad behavior. And in the conversation, Janet Jackson makes this comment: "It's hard for me because I am so against drugs and that whole thing. But at the same time, that's kind of what this field is about. It's like drug, sex, and rock and roll." She said that on national television. Of course, Amy Winehouse has recently died from her abuse problem. She goes on to insist that she herself, Janet Jackson, didn't participate in this kind of thing, and talks about some things in her background where she saw it, but held herself back from it. And King said, "It's kind of weird, isn't it, that you're not involved?" And she says, "Yes." And then after I'd see all this stuff, I'd get on the dance floor and dance. "But it's in this industry, and I've seen it, but I've never, thank God." And King says, "Thank God." And Jackson says, "Knock on wood." This is what this culture represents. Okay. Now, in my reading, probably the most scathing expose of rock music that I've run across is not done either by a musician or by a Christian author, but by a philosopher by the name of Alan Bloom. When I was a freshman in 1987, one of the best-selling books that year was this book called The Closing of the American Mind. And he has a whole chapter that's looking at the rock music issue from the standpoint of an educator. And he's not really that concerned about the moral problem. He identifies it, but his point is that the music has become such an obsession and such an addiction and such a distraction that when young people come to college, there's hardly any way you can interest them in the great tradition of liberal arts education because their mind is filled with junk. Okay? Read his chapter if you have time. I won't take the time to go through that. That is, I think, one area that we need to consider as it relates to associations of music, identifying and avoiding those elements of our culture that nonverbally send worldly, godless kinds of messages. Now, I recognize that in that rock genre, for example, there's all kinds of sub-genres, and there are a lot lighter forms of this. And so perhaps at some level, somebody would dispute the application, but I think there's a whole other category that we need to consider that the New Testament actually makes a pretty big point about. And that is this last slide that I want to share with you, that in analyzing the associations of music, we shouldn't just avoid elements that are worldly, but we should avoid elements that would be detrimental to others, in particular our brothers and sisters in Christ. And I mentioned there Romans 14 and 1 Corinthians 8 to 10. Romans 14 is on a little bit different topic, but I think its principles apply. It's talking more about things that would have certain religious associations for Jewish people. And because of their background, they're highly sensitive about it. But 1 Corinthians 8 to 10 is a little more relevant because it's talking there about Gentiles who are living in a Gentile culture and the whole question of what they're going to do with meat offered to idols. And you had some people who said, "Hey, this is just meat. I'm not sinning to eat it. It's neither going to help me get closer to God or help me get further away from God. It's just meat." And Paul grants that point. But he says, you know what? There may be all kinds of other reasons why, even though it would be hard to say the meat itself is bad, it's not just the meat itself. There may be in that culture a particular association between the meat and the idolatry that ends up creating a great problem for certain people in your congregation. And out of love for them, the wiser thing, Paul says, is to avoid it. Now, really, on one level, I don't even want to bring up this passage because meat and music are not in the same category. Meat is not the kind of nonverbal communication like music is. I think music has a lot more potential for nonverbal and even sinful communication, and it's not as neutral as something like meat. But let's suppose that you're having a hard time actually looking at the thing itself and identifying it as wrong and being sure about that. There's this whole other consideration that Paul says, look, even if it's with something like meat, often the wisest, the godliest thing to do is to avoid it because of the impact that that might have upon other people. So let's just be reminded of some of these statements in 1 Corinthians 8 to 10, and then we'll wrap it up here. It is hard to know sometimes how, in what way, to what degree we apply these principles, particularly in a corporate setting. Paul here is talking to individuals about their choices. He's not laying down a law that applies to every last issue of church life. But it nevertheless is something to consider. If you go with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and especially verse 7, he says, "However, not all possess this knowledge." What knowledge? The whole thing about, look, ultimately there's not even any idols at all. There's not any gods at all connected with this. These gods don't even exist. There's only one true God. But, verse 7, some through former association with idols eat food as really offered to an idol. And their conscience, when they do that, being weak, is defiled. Food will not commend us to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat, and no better off if we do. But take care, this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will he not be encouraged, if his conscience is weak, to eat food offered to idols? And so by your knowledge, this weak person is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died. Thus, sinning against your brothers and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat lest I make my brother stumble. It took a great deal of humility and commitment on the part of the Apostle Paul to come to that position to restrict his liberty so much. I think most of us would hate having to be vegetarians. Okay. But in his context, in his culture, he was willing to do that. And you know what? He was willing to do that because of the gospel. And so often this whole gospel issue is brought in here as though the gospel is what gives you permission to do whatever you feel like doing. When the reality is, in this passage, he says, look, Christ died for this brother. That's the gospel. And if you have the gospel as a thing that really matters to you, you don't do anything that's going to potentially lead somebody in a wrong direction. You don't want to do anything that would open the door or encourage them to sin against their conscience, even if it's not technically wrong, but they still haven't worked that out in their conscience and they are weak and they need some help. You want to be cautious about the kind of example that you're putting before them. And sometimes the example comes in connection with this association idea. Now, I'm talking there about especially styles of music that are associated with worldliness, and that in this connection, having to do with this point out of 1 Corinthians, really would lead, could lead somebody to avoid certain things. That's not all there is to say about this topic. And this is a complex issue. And we're going to come back and revisit some of these ideas. But we need to do so with a great concern for, in this case, the effect of our actions upon other people. And may the Lord help us to make right choices.